we hope and expect will be a fascinating panel on Orthodox women and leadership. For the last 12 to 13 years, Torah in Motion has been running programs in Toronto, which is where I'm from, we are based. And over the years, we've expanded our reach to 8,000 people on our email list. I would say 80% of whom no longer live in Toronto. And we are starting, this is really our second program in New York. So, and we couldn't do it without our partners, and I want to thank them, Rabbi Krauss and David Moss and Dina Berkowitz, for their help in putting together this panel. And I encourage everybody to enjoy this program. If you want to go on our website, see we've got over 1,000 of our past programs online. And if you do want to come on one of our summer trips, I invite everybody to come. And I want to thank you for joining us. So without further ado, I'm going to pass the mic to Dr. Malamud, my partner and founding for Motion. And you'll soon see why he's an expert moderator. And enjoy the evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The program tonight is organized around the idea that there's a general sense, I think, in the Orthodox community that we live in a time of unprecedented opportunities and choices for Jewish women in the realm of Torah study, as well as involvement in communal prayer and positions of leadership. And discussions about these matters throughout the community are often passionate, they're even heated, and I think that's a testimony to the significance and the centrality of the issues that are involved here. The evolution of women's role really goes back decades with innovations such as women's prayer groups and the Megillah readings, the recitation of Birkat HaGomel, Mourner's Kaddish, and high-level Torah learning. But recently, there's been more dramatic changes that are being pushed for, and it's fair to say justice was vigorously opposed within the Orthodox community, from partnership in Yanin, in which women lain and given on the yoke and lead selected parts of the service, to the skirmishes over the possibility of women, regardless of the language that we use to describe it, assuming some kind of rabbinic position within Orthodoxy. And it's this last issue, the idea of women and rabbis, that has especially provoked debate. Rabbi Avi Shafran, who's the director of public affairs for the Union Israel, wrote that female public leadership is not only antithetical to the concept of tzniut and modesty, but also to the very idea of Orthodox Judaism. He says Judaism is about obligations, not needs. Quote, hundreds of generations of Jewish women have somehow managed, without assuming roles in Jewish society, dissonant with tzniut. And hundreds of thousands of Jewish women in our own day do not feel disenfranchised in any way by the lack of female rabbis. Now, you could argue that's just a voice from the Haredi community, but the truth is that the opposition can also be found within modern Orthodoxy. On May 7, 2013, the Rabbinical Council of America reissued a statement that I made 3 years earlier, noting we cannot accept either the ordination of women or the recognition of women as members of the Orthodox rabbinate, regardless of the title. Rabbi Hershel Schaffer of Michigan University echoed Rabbi Schaffer's remarks that the female clergy violate those of tzniut. Rabbi Stephen Dworkin, the former executive vice president of the RCA, said that women's entry into the rabbinate smacks of innovations of reform and conservative Judaism, which would not be acceptable. On the other hand, Rabbi Josh Dieter commented that the issues of women's rabbinic leadership, regardless of title, is not primarily a debate over Jewish law, but over the power to define and control the franchise of Orthodox Judaism. He wrote, "This explains why none of the Orthodox organizations have challenged the Maharats at the level of their competency, or attempted to compare their competency to graduates from comparable institutions." And finally, Los Angeles Rabbi Yosef Kanevsky said, "The stupidest thing the Orthodox community does now is not have women rabbis. It wastes intellectual and spiritual talent." So tonight, I'm therefore delighted to bring together four women of impressive vision and accomplishment to take a look at the relevant issues. It's my pleasure to introduce them to you in alphabetical order. On my far left here is Marav Kulinsky Friedman. She serves at Congregation Oyem Shalom, the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C., where her duties include overseeing the conversion program and the mikvah, directing adult programming, providing pastoral counseling, and teaching. She's a graduate of Barnard College. She spent 2 years at Drisha after that before attending Yeshivat Maharat, where she was ordained. She also served as an intern at the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale and the Center for Jewish Living at JCC in Manhattan, and sits on the board of the International Rabbinic Fellowship. On far right, Dr. Dina Berkowitz is the co-founder and scholar-in-residence at Kollel HaShemah in Manhattan, an outreach congregation dedicated to re-energizing the spiritual life of all Jews. With backgrounds in law and Jewish studies from YU's Cardozo Law School and JTS, she's the co-author of Sharei Simcha, which is a mini prayer book, the first liturgical work in modern times written by Orthodox women. She's active in Jofa, and at times she simply lists her profession as, quote, Jewish community, unquote. Next to me here is Rachel Krause, the Director of Community Education right here at KJ, and she completed her BS from Stern with a major in marketing and a minor in music, including extensive study at the Juilliard School. She's currently the National Director of Partnership and Marketing for the Westfield Corporation. She recently completed her MBA at NYU. Ms. Krause has been involved in education for the past 12 years, has been teaching the Matan Bat Mitzvah program at KJ for the past 7. And finally, Dr. Jenny Rosenfeld, who is currently enrolled in the 5-year program at the Susie Bradford Women's Institute for Lack of Leadership at Midrash at Lindenbaum in Jerusalem, where women are being ordained to give instruction and rulings in Jewish law. According to Rabbi Shmuel Klitzer, who is the director of the Institute, Dr. Rosenfeld's appointment as the communal spiritual leader of Efrat by Rabbi Shmuel Riskin is the first time a woman in modern Israel has been designated to an official position of Orthodox communal religious leadership. Dr. Rosenfeld is also the author of the Newlywed's Guide to Physical Intimacy, a sexual education book aimed at Orthodox Jews. Please welcome all of our speakers. Let's begin with the macro, right? Historically, women were not, for the most part, in the forefront of religious and halachic leadership in Judaism, with some notable exceptions. But today, there are yoatzot, there are women in clerical positions, there are top-level Talmud learners and teachers, emerging poskot, leaders of day schools and seminaries, partnership and outreach beginning. The question is, why now? Why is the dynamic different? Why has female leadership risen to be one of the central issues of Orthodoxy today? Does it imply a failure in male leadership? What can women bring to the table that's currently lacking? And if they can, why was it not needed before? And if it was needed before, you know, why wasn't it implemented? And so on. So, Dr. Berkowitz, let's begin with you.
First of all, thank you to everyone who's here tonight, and I would also like to express my appreciation to Torah in Motion and to KJ and Or Torah for co-sponsoring this important and I think very necessary program with the wonderful group of co-panelists that I'm honored to be with. I recently was rereading an article about Rosh Yeshiva, whose daughter was getting married. And before discussing sort of what the conditions would be in being very traditional, the father required the future chassid to agree to what we might call a prenuptial agreement regarding in the event of a chas v'shalom divorce, but rather a clause that would be amended next to the regular traditional ketubah, in which the future husband promised that he would allow his wife to be free from all of her household duties so she would have time to learn. Now, that's pretty amazing. What's even more amazing is that the story is based on something that happened in the 17th century, where the rabbi who was Rosh Yeshiva in Mosul, whose daughter Asnat Zani was marrying a big Talmud Chacham, and it really was in many ways a marriage of equals, because it was one Talmud Chacham marrying a Talmidah Chachamah, and the father was concerned that his daughter still be able to learn. We don't have time to go through the whole story, but very briefly, what happened in that particular case is that her father died, her husband took over the yeshiva, and then her husband died. I say that because, in essence, I really think that the reason why we're here today, because of women like Asmat Barzani, that you can find sporadically in Jewish history. That's very much the, not the norm, but the exception. You can find in the Hasidic world, the way of Lemire, the Belzer Rebbe's daughter. We can find other examples even in Eastern and Central Europe of extremely learned women. But the truth was is that it was the exception. They tended to come from rabbinic homes, often where there were no sons. The fathers wanted their daughters to be learned. They came from wealthy homes. The Great Revolution, the other factor, really began with Sarah Schneier. And that is really the reason also why we're here today. Because that promoted the idea that there was a looming crisis. We talk today about crises in the Jewish community, the crisis of intermarriage, indifference, the Shidduch crisis. There's so many crises going on, you know, take a pick of the day. But the crisis at that time was the fact that you had extremely learned men who were married women who had absolutely no true understanding of Yiddishkeit other than perhaps how to run a kosher kitchen, etc., but had no grounding. Maybe they were exposed to Senna or Enna. That's it. They didn't know more than that. And it was really a looming problem that husbands could not get along with wives because there was no meeting of the minds in the religious front. And her democratization of Jewish learning for women is what we today are reaping the benefits. The Holocaust in Eastern Europe kind of put an end to that. But in America, with the gradual, I would say, understanding of the necessity for equal opportunities for women, not where you end up, but where you start from, there had to be equal opportunities. And that was certainly, in the Jewish world, I would say, the groundbreaking moment was when Rav Joseph Salavitch of Blessed Memory taught the first Gemara class at Stern College. That's the other reason why we're here today, because that really began a revolution in Jewish learning for all women, whether more to the right, more to the left, or in the center, but the idea that giving women exposure to text, to study, was part of their birthright. And once that began, then the question began, you now have a class of very educated women, where did they go with that? And I think that really then became a natural progression of where we're at today. Women first have to become exposed to and versed in enough of Jewish texts and understanding as their male counterparts. And once they did, the question then would become, could they teach others? Were they only there to teach women? Could they teach men as well? I personally have found in the work that I do, I don't tend to divide things up between men and women. There's a certain amount that women perhaps come to you for certain specific issues that they feel perhaps more comfortable, but I have a lot of men who maybe want to talk about a spiritual crisis, etc. And I think that, you know, and with this I'll conclude so we have a good time for all the questions and other people to weigh in. What I think women bring to the table is they bring their learning. I think that's really what they bring. What do they bring stylistically? I don't like to say that women are more compassionate. I think there are a lot of compassionate men. Perhaps women sometimes are more engaged in collaborative type of learning. I've seen that perhaps there's certain things we look out more for than maybe their male counterparts. I'll just also say that what people will notice that with the rise of the ordination in the non-Orthodox world of women as rabbis, there were issues that came up with that had never really been addressed before, such as should rabbis have the ability of maternity leave? And it became then a question that men began to ask. So I think sometimes what happens is that by having women in the room, there are questions that are asked that perhaps the men would not ask. I'll conclude with this. Many years ago, I was on a committee, the UJA, the UJA Committee on Medical Ethics, and the issue that was on the table was the, at that time, there was a lot of controversy about surrogate motherhood, and I was the only woman on the committee, and everybody was going around the table kind of weighing in, is it right, is it wrong, and I was a little more timid in those days, and I raised my hand, and I said, you know, I just want to make a comment, I just recently gave birth. I have to tell you something, anybody who would go through this, whether you pay them or you don't pay them, in my eyes, is a tzaddikus. Because even no matter if you pay them $20,000, to go through this is so amazing. I got completely blessed.
blank stares from all men. They had no clue what I was talking about. It was, it just kind of bypassed everybody, and then we went on to the next thing. That was a moment that my eyes opened up because I saw that I had had a different life experience. It actually impacted on how I thought about the issue, not only logically, but sociologically.
Yeah, I just want to jump off one thing that Dr. Berkowitz said.
Let's use, can we agree, just use first names, Adina.
Okay. In terms of the question of what can women bring to the table that men don't have, so I guess I want to affirm what we've said, which I don't think, sometimes people have a tendency to say that women will bring a more compassionate voice to halacha, or an empathetic voice. And that's something that upsets me, because I think that any true posting has to have compassion and empathy. It's not something that women are coming to kind of bring into a process that wasn't there before. I think for me, part of it is also a question. What will women bring to the table that wasn't being brought before? And I think it's something that we'll only know in a number of years once women have entered into that halakhic process in more, I guess, more serious numbers. But to me, I guess it's always a question.
So I wanted to ask theoretically, we can start with you, Dr. Rosenfeld. When you think about female leadership, when you think about the sort of moral underpinning of it, is it a question of rights? In other words, if you think about it, say, should women be rabbis? Well, they should have the right to be rabbis. Is that the language we would use, or would we say that, no, that's not the right language? Is it really more just about how the Jewish community can best be served? Maybe another way of putting it is, you know, people often talk about women's issues like it's always a feminist issue. And I'm wondering if you can actually transcend that language and say, no, it's not just a feminist issue, it's either a Jewish community issue or it's a fundamental human rights issue. How would we actually describe this?
So I hope that we'll actually have some dissent on this question. Is this okay with the microphone? Okay. I actually believe that that it's more of a Jewish communal issue. I'm not seeing it in the perhaps more feminist terms of, you know, the right to be everything. I see it more in terms of something that the Jewish community needs going forward. And just as, you know, we need doctors of both genders, not just female doctors for women and male doctors for men, but we need doctors of both genders because there are two genders in the world and they're going to connect with one of those options. I think the same is true with Jewish female leadership. And that's basically how I see it.
So is there dissent? No?
You
all agree. So you all see this as a Jewish community issue as opposed to a rights issue or a feminist issue. So the Jewish community needs female leaders. How come?
Because I think, without being too self-serving, I think everybody brings something different to the table. And it's a pity to lose 50%
Houston.
Yeah.
Sorry, I work in a shul, so I have to use microphones. I'm a little out of my element here. The one thing I just would want to say is that when we say it's not for the rights, I just wouldn't, I don't say that only to distance myself from feminism, which, you know, I think it's been discussed, often has become a dirty word. It actually is a feminist issue, and the way that many people react to it makes it clear that it's a feminist issue. That being said, I don't do what I do for the sake of proving that I can do what I do. I do what I do because I love doing what I do. I love my community, and thank God, you know, we have a good relationship, and the community has responded strongly to me. And if it had not, then it wouldn't be successful, which is why I say I don't do it for the sake of doing it. But I don't think it's, I think to frame it solely, exclusively as a communal issue, I would hesitate to do that, because I do think it certainly has feminist and empowerment components as well.
Can you go a little further on that, about the empowerment issue?
Well, I think that, I mean, personally, in reflecting upon, let's say, for example, the criticism that, as you know, the issue got her out as a whole and the graduation received, just for example, a lot of the criticism was actually really self-contradictory. You heard both, well, the community hasn't needed this until now, why start now? And, well, women have always served the community, why start now? Right? So it's either it hasn't never been, or it's always been. Right? That contradicts itself. I think what ultimately people are trying to express is we're just not comfortable with this. If you're not comfortable with it, well, you have to acknowledge that it's really necessary in certain communities, not all communities, certainly, but in certain communities, well, then something else is motivating, right, that criticism, right? It's not a practical, rational criticism. It speaks to something else. And I think in that particular case, it was discomfort with the empowerment of women, not to the sake of empowerment of women, I think, but how that reflects on orthodoxy, how that threatens what orthodoxy looks like. And so, like I said, in that respect, I see that as a feminist concern as well.
I want to come back to something you said, Dina, it's not about titles. I'm very intrigued by this whole issue of titles. It seems like there's an enormous amount of discussion about what we're going to call women who are in positions of leadership, even though, practically speaking, they all seem to be doing the exact same thing. So I just want to read you a couple of things that strike me, right? March 2010, the RCA says the following. We have ratified that during the course of our conversations, they were having discussions with Rabbi Weiss at that time about getting ordination. During the course of our conversations, Rabbi Avi Weiss concluded that neither he nor Yeshiva Maharaj would ordain women as rabbis, and that Yeshiva Maharaj will not confer the title of a rabbah on the graduates of their program. Even Rabbi Weiss noted at the same time that this is not about a title, it's about a degree, about women having earned the right to be poskote and spiritual leaders. And Maharaj, you said, I'm a member of the clergy, I'm going to use the word rabbi in my head. People get caught up with the title, but for me, it's about the function of what I do, which is what I think you were saying before. Now, I'm curious about this. Why would we deny women the title rabbi if they're going to be doing basically the same clerical tasks that men do? So let's flesh that out a bit. Do we avoid the title because people will get upset? In other words, it's just a kind of an appearances thing, or is a female Orthodox cleric, even if she gives sake, even if she offers pastoral counseling, is she somehow still different than a male rabbi? Otherwise, I don't really understand why we avoid the term at all. So maybe you can write it.
So I have to admit that when I saw this question and that you wanted to first send it to me, I thought, no. This is the one question that I think is the biggest challenge to deal with, and one of which I'm really of two minds about. So either way, I definitely think that title is important. And so, of course, well, what is the title? So when I'm sitting on the Amtrak today on my way in, and the standard one we've had traditionally in America, that of course it comes along more to men than to women. And so we're all grappling with these issues of, is our goal for men and women, you know, to look exactly the same, or is it to acknowledge certain differences? And where I get particularly stuck is that I completely agree with what we said earlier. I don't think that men and women tend to have, you know, these inherent differences. I certainly know certain male rabbis who I think are probably more caring and empathetic than I am. Not that I'm not, but we're just, you know, extremely so. And where they don't, you know, male rabbis who are less so. Does that mean that I'm flawed? No, it just means I have a certain personality, and others have certain personalities as well. And so, to a certain degree, does Namarat take away from it? Does it enable people to say, oh, you're not a rabbi, in a way that's probably somewhat problematic? Yeah, but on the other hand, does it acknowledge that maybe there are certain slight differences in roles? Also, yes, I'll give you an example. I started my job in August 2013. For the first 10 months, every single day, whatever job since Sunday, it was later, I was at 6:30 a.m. moving. I was the only woman there the vast majority of the time. And over the course of the beginning of the summer, I developed some health issues. My doctor basically said, well, you're waking up at 5:30 in the morning and going straight to work and not really leaving until, you know, 9 p.m. You should probably start to see it. And so my personal line agreed that I wouldn't be coming to 6:30 a.m. shop group anymore. Now, if a male, assistant rabbi, essentially, because that's essentially the role that I fill, right, developed, you know, said, oh, I can't come to Shakrit anymore, would that look different? Probably, right? Because we get about 20-something men and zero women most of the time. That's just how things are. On the other hand, my husband is very frustrated because he still goes and he says the men are starting to creep onto the women's side a little bit. You know, so it's sort of, you know, he regrets that I can't be there. And so, like, to me, that's a story that, you know, reflects just the tension. On the one hand, it's a little bit different, but on the other hand, it's not that different. We also opened a mikvah when I asked, okay, could a male rabbi have, you know, become the director? No, right? Probably not. But so in that degree, Maharaj is different than a rabbi. But like I said, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm doing, you know, fewer things than a male rabbi would do it. So there are differences just in terms of how it affects the conditions of us socially. Obviously, the mikvah thing is more easily reduced to gender identity. But I don't think that they're unequal, or one is lesser than, or that one is greater than in that respect. So, I'm still stuck in that tension. I don't really have one great answer to that.
So I think that healthy tension is a good thing. I think tension perpetuates growth. I think through friction, you create movement. So these are all healthy discussions to have, and very and a healthy tension to feel and grapple with. And I definitely struggle with this in certain respects as well, that titles are important, because when you come in and you say, I am an EVP, or I am an SVP, or I am a director, that means you command a certain salary range, maybe you get the corner office, or whatever the case is. So there is something that comes along with titles, although there's been a trend, and again, I speak kind of from the corporate world and the business world, there has been a trend to open floor seating, that you don't have, you all sit together, there's a lot of camaraderie, a lot of collaboration. Because very often we end up, our titles end up hindering what we're able to do, and they paralyze us sometimes, as opposed to enabling us. So I think that very often titles can create differences, and titles can create distance between what's possible and what's actually being done. And I think if you take a giant step back and look at the work that women are involved with, this is about, that's a kodesh. You're talking about people that are looking to grow Jewish communities, looking to inspire Jewish communities, looking to perpetuate learning and Torah and values and chesed and tzedakah and camaraderie. So when we take a giant step back, it's not about pushing bottom line revenue. We're talking about enhancing people's lives, enhancing our identity as Jewish people. And when I look at that kind of from the 35,000 foot view, I don't need a title. It's not about the title. It's about doing the work and getting involved and developing those personal relationships and developing communal relationships and helping foster a community and an environment that's growth, continuous engagement in Jewish identity. So to me, when we take a step back, the titles don't mean as much when you look at the beautiful work that's being done.
What is that?
that a standard that you use for anything else? In other words, if you pass the bar, people are not calling you a lawyer. If you pass years of medical school, people are calling you a doctor. If you pass years of counseling, people are calling you CPA. Would women across the world will say, well, that's okay, because I like the work I do. I'm healing lives. I'm a doctor. You don't call a doctor, because it's about the work. So it seems to me that's really not a standard that you use in other places. I'm just curious why that's a standard that you would accept in this line.
That's excellent and very thoughtful. I guess I can just speak for myself personally. Like, just as an example, I'll be pulled onto projects at work because I'm capable, not because of my title. So I might report into, again, the executive vice president, but I have the right skill set to be able to deliver that project, to be able to do that project well. So it's irrespective of my title that I'm able to contribute to the greater team. So I think that there's tension with it. It's not an easy answer. You're right. But somebody has worked hard and has accomplished something, and there is a certain amount of honor, respect, a desire to be called by the title that you deserve. But again, I think that when I take that step back and look at more macro, what we're really trying to accomplish, what we're really trying to move forward here, I think it's greater than any one person. It's greater than any one title. And I would argue the same for men as well. I think that if this is what we're really trying to accomplish, we need to relook at the system and think about how we're treating this role.
You think we should call them wise guys?
If somebody met you on the street, Jenny, and they said to you, "Oh, I read about you in the paper, Rabbi Rosenthal," would you correct them?
Okay. So I think that like everyone else has expressed until now, I feel the tension. I feel the tension very strongly. I would correct them. And I think that in having a doctorate, which I got before coming into this world of halachic leadership, was kind of a way of copping out and saying, you know what, everyone else in my program, you guys can debate do you want the title Rabbi or not. I'm okay with the title that I have. But I guess I want to say another word about attention. Rabbi Greenberg famously says that you always want to be 5 to 10% ahead of the community, but not more. Because once you're more, then you're ready out of the community that you're trying to bring with you. And I think that tension that we all feel around the issue of rabbi, and I have to say very viscerally, as someone who grew up in the Orthodox world, from kind of a young age when people ask me, oh, would you like to be a woman rabbi? Very viscerally, I said, no. And even when I came into this program in Israel, I came into the Dayanu track because I said, okay, that's not being a rabbi, that's being something different. There's a visceral reaction that I feel, even as a woman, a certain discomfort with the title. And I think that gives me more respect for others who also feel discomfort with it. And I think that saying that we don't use the title for appearances is not, it's kind of not a shallow answer. I think that it's not just about appearances. I think that sometimes there are visceral reactions that the community feels that we have to acknowledge. And it's only by acknowledging them that we can bring the community with us and not leave the community behind. So I hear your question, your attack of Rachel. I think it's very real, but at the same time, I think that we have to kind of focus on the larger picture, what we want to do for the community, and also how we ourselves feel.
Just going back to Jewish history, I mentioned Asnat Barzani. So there in the 17th century, they were faced with the same problem. What do we call this woman who is the Rosh Hashiva, right? What is her title? So the title they gave her was Tana'it. So that was one example we had. The other example we have is in Prague, Rebecca Tinkener wrote a Sefer Menachem Rivka. I think there are two copies, one at Hebrew University Library, the other at JTS. The printer, I guess he was worried that maybe somebody would burn down his the printing press. He gave an explanation as to why he was printing a book that was written by a woman, a Sefer written by a woman. And what's very interesting is that he gave her the title Rabbanit. Now, I have not traced the history of her, whether she was married to a rabbi or not, but it seems that, again, everything old is new again, everything new is old again. these are not new discussions. We have Jewish history to look at. We have in other, I would say, areas. 15 years ago, I remember at a JOFA conference, I gave a talk where I said, you know, in England, there are two kinds of lawyers. There's a barrister and there's a solicitor. They both can function working within the legal system, but they have different responsibilities, different things that they can do. And perhaps that's a guideline here, because it seems to me people have a very visceral reaction. That's what I've noticed, for good and for bad. Just over that, and then ends up, it KOs than anything else that you're able to do.
I like very much what you said about Rabbi Greenberg's talking about 5 to 10%. It raises a kind of central issue of this kind of tension between progression and communal stability, right? You have people who are upset, they think about the broader implications of the community, about the change of the limits that are happening too fast. It's interesting that Rabbi Kanevsky, I quoted off the top as saying that not having female rabbis is actually a stupid thing. The same person said that the best way to derail a good idea is by moving too far too fast. So he's also aware of the fact that there's a kind of timing. And he says if we want to continue advancing women's participation in communal leadership, we have to have a common communal sense. So I hear that. Rachel, what I wanted to know is where is the balance really wrong, right? Because you have an undeniable fact that if you make radical change too quickly, you lose people. But, you know, we are in modernity. Modernity is about progression. How do you know when you're moving too slowly, and how do you know if you're moving too quickly?
It's a great question. I think there are probably more subjective definitions to that than objective definitions to that. But I think that anytime you want to create long-term sustainable change, those are all very important words. It's long-term and sustainable change. When you want all of that together, it can't happen because you have one remarkable woman doing something. It can't happen because you have five remarkable women. There has to be a structure, infrastructure, system, methodology in order to progress that whole movement forward. So I think that we're part of that. I think we're part of that evolution. But in order to ensure that it's not just a personal success, it's not just about me and my role in the community, but it creates a platform and creates an opportunity for women all over the world, for women in institutions throughout the world, to be able to advance and hold these communal roles and hold these leadership type of positions and the pastoral counseling and all the beautiful things that come along with it, in order to ensure long-term sustainable growth and sustainable system, I think that it's correct. I think we have to move at a pace we can incorporate feedback. We have to move at a pace where we make sure we have the right leaders in place and the right system and process moving forward. It needs to be supported with structure, with infrastructure, and with a model and with methodology.
I mean, we have, so let's take what you said and plug it in into real things that are happening. So if I were to ask you, partnership in young, too slow, too fast?
Okay. So for me personally, I mean, it's tough. I personally find that that's not necessarily an outlet that I seek. I know that becomes more challenging when you have women and men both alike who seek that as an outlet. For me, that's less of a draw. So I don't necessarily feel as comfortable commenting on that front because it's less about my personal desire. Although I do think that it's for me that was probably a little bit too fast.
All right, so let's go across the table, and everybody tell me something that you think is going too slowly. Choose your own thing, and tell me something that you think maybe is going too quickly. You told me what you think is going a bit too quickly, yeah?
Yes.
So let's, I'll come back to my room if you tell me what you think is going too slowly. Or maybe there's more than one thing.
Well, I don't know if I can point to one thing in particular, but what I can say is that I've lived in Manhattan for 10 years, and then moved to D.C. almost 2 years ago, and you know, when you're in Manhattan, you sort of lose sight of everybody else, which is a very New Yorker thing to do. But I sort of think took for granted certain things that here are considered normal, that in other places is considered revolutionary. So what's that? Women's jewelry, right? Women's tequila, where I was sort of like, okay, you know, in my mindset, it's like women's tequila, something I grew up with. Really came to the fore when I was probably about 20. And you know, to me, that's mainstream. And then I come to you know, certain places are just in a different schedule than other places. I don't really feel comfortable commenting anything specific. It's moving too quickly. I haven't had time to think about that. But the one thing I'll just say is that I think that you briefly made really good points about the sustainability. And I think that what a lot of the new changes have proven is that they are sustainable. So, you know, my most familiar framework, of course, is Maharaj, which when we started, I think we all took a leap of faith and sort of said, well, let's do this together, but, you know, I don't know. We'll see where it goes, and hopefully it'll go to a good place. Lo and behold, we had our graduation in 2013. Thank God we all got jobs, we got great jobs. And then as soon as graduation hit, Amarat was flooded with applications from women who clearly, I think probably we could say, we're you know, not sure where it would go, but once it saw us successful, it really attracted a lot of interest and a lot of dedication. And it is continuing to grow. And so in that sense, I think it absolutely is a change that's sustainable. Of course, many people argued it was too quickly, but I think that our success has shown that I don't believe that it was. So it's hard to know, but I think sustainable is really the telling point of whether something is moving too quickly or too slowly.
So let's choose another issue that I'm going to talk about in the same framework, which would be Mikvah. As all of you know, next Friday afternoon, May 15, 2015, Rabbi Gary Flindell will be sentenced on 52 counts of voyeurism for having set up cameras and secretly filmed women in the mikvah. Assistant U.S. Attorney Amy Zubretsky noted that in addition to the camera and a clock radio, Flindell had taped them using mini cameras embedded in a tissue box and a tabletop fan. He faces a maximum of a year in jail and a fine of up to $2,500 on each of the first 30 counts and $1,000 fine on the remainder. This tragedy has been commented on a great deal in the past number of months, and our business here is to raise it in a very particular context, the context that we've just been speaking about. I'd like you to all comment on whether this is something where we're too slow, too fast. In other words, what might be the role of Orthodox women in terms of the overall conversion process, as well as the sequence in the mikveh itself on the day of conversion. Let's make that more specific. Do you believe that the procedure is fine as it is, that it's simply that obviously Rabbi Flindell abused the good process, or do you believe that conversion needs immediate alteration? In other words, we'd be saying this is too slow in terms of women's involvement. Do you believe that, for instance, the male Beit Din must or should be literally present at a woman's conversion, or do you believe that female shemichot should be used, etc.? We'll start with Dr. Rosenberg.
So I definitely believe that women should be used at least as shemichot Beit Din. I guess I want to start off by saying that I think that the process, although I think it is flawed, I think that when it works perfectly, it can work. One of the first things that I did after entering into this role in a frat was to go to Balei Shvut to witness a conversion. Rabbi in charge of conversions there invited me to come and see what actually happens when women convert. And I came, and it worked very well. But that was only because there was an extremely committed mikvah lady set things up in the most appropriate possible way, and that the rabbis and the Beit Din themselves were very sensitive and aware of the issues and behaved, I think, maybe shirazim. However, when I came home and I was talking to my husband and I said to him, you know, I watched this conversion and it really was okay. So he said to me, you can't expect the whole system to be built on something that is okay when 100% of the factors kind of collide to make it okay. Because that means that in many situations, it isn't okay. And it still needs a tikkun, it still needs a fixing. The Rabbi Michal Tkachinsky has written a wonderful article, which is available online, which goes through sources beginning beginning with Inquiry and Follows, which shows the distinction between the way that a male convert would immerse in the way that a female convert would immerse Stephen Hillerin, which is also a very early source, which spoke about women bringing other women to be Tovel and men bringing men. Down to more contemporary Chabot, such as the Mishnah Uziel, or Rav Uziel, permitted women to function as emissaries of the Beitin. So that's something which I think has enough serious sources behind it. I think that it's a step that the Orthodox community is ready to take. I think that there's a further step, which is a step that our Rosh Kollel, Rav Shuki Reif, speaks about in terms of women serving not only as emissaries of the Beit Din, but as the Beit Din itself, is also a step that could, should be taken. I don't know if that's a step that the community is ready for yet. I think that the Shivot Beit Din would be the first step, and then down the line, I would hope that, it would evolve, as well as evolving in terms of women who have done enough learning to serve as a Beit Din, to then serve as a Beit Din for Gior.
Having worked with candidates for conversion, I have really seen the importance for the women to have another woman there. When you go in even just for a preliminary meeting with the Beit Din, it is so overwhelming for them. They feel so vulnerable, as is, that they literally need somebody to hold their hand. And just for that alone, as a process, and I spoke to some of the rabbis of the Beit Din, and I said, it's not about having me, it's about having anybody who comes in. It really makes a very big difference. In fact, when it came time for this particular woman to undergo the conversion, somebody, one of the rabbis said, you know, you can go in with her. So I said, well, before I go in to watch it, I want to get her permission that it's okay for me to be there. And I think that was kind of like a light bulb went off in his head, because that was, again, the idea that you have to be very sensitive to the person you're dealing with, even if you think you're being very sensitive by sending me in as the woman, as an adjunct to the mikvah lady. And she said it was fine, but I saw the difference, because afterwards, you know, she said to me that it just made, she said I she was practically felt like she was gonna, you know, burst out in tears the first time, because it was a little bit of a complicated case. She said, I needed to hold your hand. I just couldn't go in there alone.
So this is a very, I'm based in Washington, D.C., so this is unfortunately a very central topic for us in our shul, to a lot of conversions, and immediately became a very serious question. And so the one thing I want to say first is that a lot of the language industry was like, oh, thank God you're a moderate, right? Or every conversion from now on for women should just be in charge of, women should just be in charge and that's it. I just want to say that I think we have to be very careful to speak in those terms, because, I can be just as corrupt as a man, right? No one person should have sole authority, regardless of whether they're a man or a woman. And I think that there needs to be more oversight. So everything that happened prompted our shul to immediately develop a very thorough document of the conversion guidelines in our synagogue, which outline exactly what we expect of the person who is converting, because often it's not a transparent process, and also what we provide to them. And included in that is the phone number of a male board member and a female board member whom any conversion candidate may contact anonymously if they want to report any suspicions of abuse or anything funky on behalf of, Rabbi Gonzalez or me. So it's not just about centralizing the power with someone who, is a woman. It's about making sure that there are proper systems in place, that no one has the sole authority over anything. And this is actually a place where I'll say that, to answer the previous question, moving too quickly or too slowly, I was really honestly disturbed at the reaction of a lot of, let's say, understanding of this particular situation. And, you know, I'm very grateful to the rabbis who, and other individuals who spoke out and introduced new tshuvot, new responsa, ways of having a love with the way that you said, you know, we all started this ages ago, and unfortunately it didn't get enough attention until a crisis hit. But that's, I think, where real leadership is, in willing to see a problem and really understand the human condition behind it, and really be willing to move forward, even if it's not the most popular opinion. And we did adopt that position in our shul, and that same woman converted a holy meeting in the room, and the male baiting outside the door that was closed.
So I agree with all the points that have been made, and I have to say that I've been very fortunate, with my husband and I together, have been involved with a number of conversions. Some in our prior role when we were at the Manhattan Jewish Experience in Midtown, and then most recently for the past 2.5 years under the phenomenal leadership of Rabbi Lichtenstein. I also want to acknowledge Rabbi Lichtenstein's wife is here as well. It's a pleasure to have you here. And to your point, Jenny, that I think that you have individuals and yichidim that do it with such dignity and such respect.
Let's take a step sideways. We've been talking very much about all of you in a professional capacity. I'm also very intrigued by the human element here, about all of you are wives and moms. And I wonder what you see the effect of all of this talk about women as leaders on you simply as human beings, as partners, as mothers. There's been a lot of feminist discourse, I'm sure everybody is aware, in the last number of years, a lot of writing, discussing the question of whether career and home can be balanced, and whether professional life is taking too big a toll on personal and familial commitments. So on the one hand, girls growing up today may take it for granted that a Jewish woman can serve as a Jewish leader, and I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing to have that as a model in your brain. But will the stress on family life be difficult, be dangerous, in fact, for you? And I think the last component here is that maybe how should we be teaching our sons? You know, should we be teaching our sons to sort of reimagine and adopt their role in the family in response to the burgeoning of female Jewish leadership?
One of my favorite questions has been my youngest, who's 12, has often come home and said, "Ima, my friends ask me, what does your mom do for a living?" So she says, "I'm trying to explain what exactly it is you do. How can you explain it?" And I see in that question much of what we're talking about tonight of titles and obligations and balancing. I think, you know, the women's movement came along and said, you can have it all. And then we found out rapidly that you can have it all, but you can't necessarily have it all at the same time. And I think, for example, what I do, I think it would have been much more difficult to have, thank God, 5 children if when they were very, very small, I was trying to do what I started a number of years ago to do. It would be like a physical impossibility, because then I would not have been good at anything. And I kind of came to recognize once my kids were at a certain age and the youngest was a certain age, then it became easier. But I think the modeling is very important. I think your question also is very important, because it's not just, we normally think of modeling for girls. I think it's also modeling for the boys. It's also modeling for men, because it's important for them to see. In a very broad sense, I'll just tell you a kind of a funny story that happened. I've gotten like various reactions. Sometimes people come to me after Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur services and kind of stumble that we have free high holiday services. So a couple came to me and said, you know, we're Reform Jews. We happen to be in New York. We didn't know where to go. We came into your shul, and the first thing we saw was a mechitza, and we were ready to leave because it so went against what we're used to. We don't want to stay. But then she said, my husband said, well, we're not going to hear the shofar. I want to hear it. So we stayed. She said, you know what? It wasn't so bad not to sit with my husband. I had a good time, you know, meeting the other women. We try to keep the talking level low. But then I had a reaction from some other people. Someone came up to me. He was wearing jeans. His head was shaved. He had a tattoo. He had an earring. It turned out he had grown up Hasidic. And he was an ex-Satmar, had grown up in Williamsburg, totally, I don't like that term, off the derech, but just taking a different path. So he said to me, you know, when I walked in, and I came in just as you were starting your Dvar Torah, he said, my initial reaction is, why did my friend drag me to a Reform synagogue? So, you see, people perceive different things. Now, he subsequently said, you know what, I didn't know. Again, this is very interesting. He said, I had no idea there are educated women who know these things. It had nothing to do with what his current level of observance was. He was not socialized to that. Yeah. And I recently had someone who was in our acapella group also, who grew up Hasidic. He was sitting around our table, and he heard one of my older daughters say something in the Gemara. So he talked to me. He goes, you know Gemara? So she goes, yes, I learned it in school. He goes, you learned it in school? What kind of school do you go to? So she explained where she goes to my aunt. And then he said, well, you must be the exception. And then my other daughter said, no, I learned it too. You learned it too? Went around the table, someone else who goes to Central, and you learned it too. So then he finally looked at me and he said, well, you probably couldn't have learned Gemara, you know? I said, no, I do. Again, he said, I never heard of such a thing. You would not think that in the 21st century, but again, that is part of what it is. No one's waving a red flag, this is what we do. It comes up. You want to stand for learning. I think that is the modeling that works, whether it's for male or if it's for female, if it's for girls or for boys.
Yeah. So I want to agree with you. I think that learning-wise it works, but as someone, I guess, who's still a little bit behind you in terms of the kids, my youngest just turned one and traveled in from Israel with me, I feel the tension much more acutely right now, not in terms of learning, but in terms of questions of the synagogue participation. And I think my current job at Efrat as an Anigar Rukhani, I've been appointed by Rabbi Riskin, who's the Rav here, so I'm not associated with a particular synagogue. But I think that in the case of the Maharads, and I'd be very interested to hear, I don't know if you're dealing with it yet, or how you'll deal with it, in a few months, but I think that their attention is much more acute. I spoke on the phone with Rachel Cole Feingold, and she was telling me about attending the daily minyan and what that means in terms of her attending and her husband not attending. And I think it raises a question for me of what the ideal model of female leadership looks like. And I'm hesitant to say that model has to look like someone whose youngest kid is, you know, 10 years old. I'm also hesitant to say that it needs to entail a total flipping of roles, that when the woman is in leadership, then the husband kind of gets released from his human. I think that there's a tension, and I think that we do need to reimagine it. I just don't know how.
I think there's a certain amount of calling intellectual honesty, that there is not a one-size-fits-all for this. I know that Daniel and I evaluate this on a very regular basis. So for me, I have, you know, kind of, again, the full-time corporate kind of side, and then Daniel and I both hold these roles as directors of community education at UJ. And thank God we have three kids under the age of six, so it's busy. But there is a constant balance, a constant evaluation. I think it's you know, knowing that you're putting your potential to use, knowing that you're getting sifukai nefesh out of what you're doing for the greater community, making sure that you're supporting your spouse's journey equally, and that changes, that dynamic isn't always the same. And I think also as children, as their needs evolve, we need to be to exercise a certain ability in leadership at the total expense of missing out on other things. And I think that as women, I think in particular, we struggle with that balance. It's something that I feel in the workplace. I was fortunate, I actually got to spend a bit of time with Sheryl Sandberg, who you mentioned before, who's unfortunately going through a personal tragedy now. And it's tough. And there's leaning in, and there's leaning back, and there's leaning sideways, and there's all these different types of mechanisms that need to be evaluated and reevaluated. And I think it takes a certain amount of intellectual honesty, a certain amount of desire and communication and growth for the couple themselves. And I think there is a tension that is bound up in that that needs to be looked at, evaluated, recalibrated at times. But it's a shifting dynamic. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all, and it's a one-time answer that's set for life. It's something that needs to be evaluated.
So as Jenny, as you said, not an issue that my husband and I have dealt with quite yet, but hopefully we'll be dealing with in August. Right before Rosh Hashanah, incidentally, which is itself raising a whole host of interesting questions. But I just will say that even until now, if we're hosting Shabbos lunch or a 40-person barbecue for lunch on Shavuos, my husband is the one running home during Torah reading to put the food on. To make sure everything is set up, let the dog out, all that stuff, right? That's not me, I'm in shul. And I have friends who are, said to me, I think when we first started the job, if it ever has been with kids, like, Yomi will be the one going to Minyan, right? I mean, he's got a chiyuv, he's got to go to Minyan, right? And I don't know, we obviously haven't figured that out yet. We haven't had a conversation about what that will look like for Minza, but only one of us can go. Sometimes he's the one who's not there on Thursday night because he's cooking, and there's food on the stove. And no one in our shul expects anything different. And I also just want to say that, like, Rabbi Hertzfeld, to his enormous credit, he's home every day between 4:30 and 7 with his kids. That's his family time. He and his wife have worked out an arrangement. I believe she gets home around. And also, he's home for dinner time with his kids. Saturday night, driving them around to all the bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and all that stuff. Sundays, if there's a shul event, there's a shul event, but if not, he's with his kids, and he's very clear about that. And so I think that, to a certain degree, does it present some inherent complexities, of course. To another degree, have clergy, I think, often bought into, there's always something to go to. There's always something to go to. And to a certain degree, you have to establish some of those boundaries for yourself, I think, regardless of whether you're the wife or the husband or the father or the mother. And I think that's really key. And I'm grateful I'm in a synagogue that doesn't expect anything different.
So,
okay, I'm going to be asking one more question. Can I just see, do people have questions that they want to ask to show the answers? So I'm going to finish up and I'm going to get my exercise and go out into the audience. Okay, let's talk about the future, actually, the following way. I'm going to read you something from a conservative Jewish rabbi named Scott Perlow, who published a piece in the Washington Post about the fact that many of his congregants, who are young and liberal, don't like the idea of a female rabbi. He writes, "I remember the mother who wanted to switch from another synagogue so that her daughter's bat mitzvah would not be performed by a woman. I remember the professional 30-something woman who confessed that she didn't like the local rabbi largely because the rabbi was female. I remember the glass-ceiling-shattering Jewish comedian who told me that female rabbis are terrible. When asked their reasons, this quietly uneasy population usually says that the idea of a female rabbi just doesn't feel right, or that because they were raised with male clergy, that just feels more comfortable. And that's about as far as I get. There's no other conversation stopper than it feels better this way." And he goes on to talk about the number of liberal Reform Jews who kind of hinted at their preference for males over females. And interestingly, all of these comments are from people who support gender equality. And they're not just an older generation. Professionals in their 20s and 30s are saying the same thing, that they can't handle female religious leaders. So my question is really, I think about this question as, quote, the men's club.
Many more Orthodox men that I've spoken to see partnership in any of this being something not about equality, but about women. And they'll never ask a woman a halachic question. They say that if she's qualified, and they'll never attend such minyanim, even if they become sanctioned, and so on. So I guess I want to ask you all, when you think about being a female leader, do you think there'll be a time when this male aversion will change, that men will also eventually turn to women to answer questions, and, or when this is going to be a kind of segregated thing, right? Women for women. Will female leadership become normative? Will it become absorbed with relatively little fanfare? How do you see the future? Let's go down the line.
I think at a certain point, it's just going to be a matter of changing perspective. So our shul is big that thriving. We've got well over 200 kids. Now, all of whom, right, know that there's a rabbi and a maharad, right, women in Orthodoxy can serve in this position.
And then kind of pass on the message that this is worth seizing upon.
I I think it's an evolutionary process rather than a revolutionary process. It happens, but Orthodoxy's strength is that it happens at a slower pace so that people can become more acclimated to it. And perhaps also within Orthodoxy, we're a little more sheltered than in the non-Orthodox world. Professor Sylvia Barrett-Fishman has written about the flight in the non-Orthodox world of men from Jewish life that's very, very frightening, that because within a rapid period of time, if you look at who's enrolled in rabbinical school, the Reform and Conservative movement, the cantorial school, it's overwhelmingly women. So you'll go into a synagogue, the rabbi is a woman, the cantor's a woman, the president, the synagogue's a woman, the head of the Hebrew school's a woman, so that men kind of come in and say, well, there's no place for me. It's gotten so, quote unquote, bad that the Union of Reformed Judaism, one of their last conventions, had a male-only service. No women were allowed because they were trying to create male bonding. They had these men's retreats, etc. So that I don't see that happening within the Orthodox world. But I think part of our strength of creating Kehilot and a covenantal community is making everybody feel included and inclusive so that you don't feel that one party is taking over. And I'll just end with an anecdote that happened to me. I always daven, but I started going to a daily minyan 7 years ago when I was saying Kaddish for my father. So you know that experience that women have where you walk in and I have to make sure that I'm not later than 6 minutes because that's when they'll get to the first Kaddish and I'm trying to get the kids out to school. And I walk in and nobody's davening because they're waiting for the 10th man. And I come in and they hear the elevator and they're eagerly assuming, well, now we can get moving because we all have to get to work. And then you see them look at me and then their face flips. So the gabbai came over to me and he said, you know, he said, I just want to let you know, he said, you maybe don't count for the minyan, but we still want you here. We still count for coming. And I think that, in a sense, is really what the community has to strive for. We might not count for a minute. There might be things that we are not part of, but nonetheless, we're still part of the community.
Well, I think you all count for us. And I want to thank you all for a splendid conversation. I'm going to open up the floor to questions from the audience, but please give them all a warm hand. So what we're going to do is I'm going to go around, we're going to take all the questions at once and answer them all.
Whatever position
is okay. What I want to say, I don't think mimic exactly what the rabbi says. If you have a heart, so you are thinking that in the Jewish world that it's better a woman to go to a woman than to a man. And I think as a woman in Karat, everyone can find his niche. And you don't need to mimic. I think that's what the, that's my own thinking.
Okay, I've heard a lot of statements. This is question period. Not statement period. I grew up in Rabbi Willie's shul.
knowing that Rabbi Weiss's shul was kind of a stone's throw away, and it was a place that I started attending for the beautiful Friday night davening at a certain point. But that balancing question has always kind of torn at me, because of where I came from, I feel a very strong desire, personally, not to cut myself off from the larger community. Because I think once you cut yourself off from it, then you also cut off who you can influence. I want to be able to go back to the school where I grew up. I want to be able to talk to people in that community. And that's why I personally would feel very uncomfortable saying, I'm within open Orthodoxy and not within traditional Orthodoxy, because traditional Orthodoxy is the place that I want to be ultimately helping.
When it comes to mission statements, the best kind of mission statement is who's positioned in the back of the shul as people walk in on Shabbos morning and how they're greeted. You can write whatever you want as part of your official mission statement, but the face, the actual face that you give people tells you whether you're open. It's not about being open Orthodox, it's just about being a welcoming, nurturing spiritual environment. And I think that that really touches on what I see as the larger crisis that we're in. People are looking for connection. They're looking for connection with each other, with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. They're trying to find a greater level of spirituality, because now we're a very educated generation. We know how many hours to wait between meat and milk. We know how to make our coffee Shabbos morning. The bigger questions are still looming. And that's what I think people are looking for communities for, and seeking out religious guides to help them to understand all the things that go on in the world, whether those guides were male or female.
So the last answer is on the seniors.
Okay, so to answer the question of the unit of leadership, we could get into a halachic discussion, but that's not what I want to say. What I want to say is that I think that sometimes what we imagine siyut to be isn't necessarily what it actually is. And I think of the area of issues of sexuality, which is something that I worked in a lot before coming into this realm. And there too, people would always say, how do you have a public discussion of sexuality? Isn't that antithetical to siyut? And I feel, I guess, there as in here, that sometimes there are overarching issues that are important and that are Jewish issues, and we use tzniut as a way of kind of pushing issues off the table. And we push those issues off the table. People's lives are in danger, and people's relationship with Judaism, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, is in danger. So I feel that that needs to be thought of as well.
Okay, so we're going to wrap up and ask Cameron to say the closing remarks.
I want to thank you for a wonderful panel, and I'm looking forward to Dr. Roosevelt to hearing you in Toronto tomorrow night, where we're doing part two of the panel. Anybody who wants to come, you're more than welcome. And really, I hope you enjoy it. We'll be interested in hearing your feedback, ideas for other programming. I want to thank again everybody.